It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 108 for Friday, the 25th of January, 2012. This week, we'll take a look at the murky world of revenge pornography, which has hit the news this week as a group of individuals are trying to make it illegal. Plus, a new public art project in the UK aims to let you talk to your local lamppost. Why? We'll explain exactly why later. And are you planning a visit to North Korea anytime soon? Because if so, you're now going to be allowed to take something into the country that hasn't ever been allowed before. We'll tell you what later as we dive deep into this week's ball pool of Wired news. Ahoy, ahoy, Nate Langston here. I've just referred to myself off-air as an archangel of the Wired.co.uk podcast. I'm going to stick with that for the rest of the show. And joining me are cherubs Ian Steadman.
Hello.
And Olivia Solon, who for some reason I've introduced after Ian.
And without an underscore.
The underscore, I'm sorry. It's Olivia underscore Solon, of course.
Yes.
We're back in the on the Wired cloud floating through our news sky. We've got a very interesting show coming up, and we're not really going to... We've got no banter on our sheet here. Normally I put a piece of banter for us
we've
to have a bit
the banter
of...
Off.
Small talk
off air about angels and you being the archangel.
Yeah. I don't know. I think we're all archangels. You know, in this room, we're of equal angel status. Let's start, Liv, with some beatboxing techniques, shall we?
Because yes. I wish I could bash out some beatboxing.
Well, hang on. Why don't I have a quick listen to what beatboxing is before we start this?
Look at this extra technique, dumb rat.
This is beatboxing. Why are we talking about this week, Liv?
We are talking about this because a team of linguists from the University of Southern California have actually studied a beatboxer by popping him inside an MRI scanner.
As you do.
Weirdly, there's not been very much... Well, perhaps not weirdly. Perhaps it's unsurprising that there's been very little studies done of beatboxing. And so this team of linguists wanted to find out exactly how people who have this skill... make the sounds, like how are they moving their throats and other vocal organs to make the kind of percussive sounds that they make when they're beatboxing. So they found a willing participant, a 27-year-old male who they can't reveal the name of which.
That's weird.
There's rules about studies that means you can't, you kind of have a participant.
Oh yeah, you have like M, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And he'd been beatboxing for many years, and so what they did was pop him inside this MRI scanner and get him to kind of show his range of sounds that he can make, and various different drum sounds and beats and rapped lyrics as well, and as well as kind of freestyle combinations.
Interesting. And what did they find?
First of all, I think they had to develop a really interesting technique of MRI kind of video, basically. They developed it specifically to analyse these vocal organs, which are quite complex, and to kind of see the airflow. So that was kind of a big challenge in the first place, as was recording sound inside an MRI scanner. If anyone's ever been in an MRI, it's one of the noisiest. It's kind of like being inside a cement mixer, but possibly louder.
That would totally make me feel completely calm and at ease.
Yeah. So they had to develop a kind of custom noise-cancelling microphone system to so they could like cross-reference this with the scans that they made. But what the interesting thing that they found was that beatboxers can actually produce a range of sounds, like the full range of sounds in the human language, of all human languages, even if they don't speak some of those languages, if that makes sense. So you know how there's some guttural sounds and clicks in some African languages, such as Xhosa. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Xhosa.
Hossa.
The XH is a click.
Okay.
It's like a kind of like click at the back of your throat sound.
Yeah. And then there are some kind of ejective consonants which are common in kind of it's Mayan language originally of Quechua and Chechen, which is obviously from Chechnya. And so they found that the beatboxers make a really wide range of noises, which we kind of know, but they think that they're very similar to some other languages, and so they want to study this a bit further.
I do wonder where this could have implications for better ways to learn foreign languages. I mean, speaking from somebody who's presently learning to speak Japanese, there are a lot of words and places, and the person tutoring me sort of has to explain whereabouts in the mouth your tongue should be.
Exactly.
And it's really weird to think, oh, my tongue, I need to really think about the position in my mouth where my tongue is. It's sort of between a T, when your tongue is kind of just behind your teeth, and between, say, an L, where it's kind of just floating in the middle of your mouth. It's not between those two. I just plucked those out. But that, it's that sort of thing. And but so that, it does make me wonder if there's some sort of scientific way that we can help language learning as a result of this.
Speech therapy.
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what they're doing. And what the kind of next step, the next thing they want to study is kind of beatboxers who can give the impression that they're singing and playing beats at the same time. And people like Razelle do this really well.
Look at this technique, Tom.
And so they find that kind of absolutely baffling. So that's something they want to examine next. But I don't think they did it in this particular study.
Interesting. Well, it's something we'll have to follow up on. Can either of you two beatbox?
No. You can a little bit, can't you?
I'm not going to do it on the podcast.
Oh, go
on. You got to do it.
No, I can't. I'm not that good.
It's just like, I can't do that. That's me trying to do it. See, that's,
there we go.
That's it. You just loop that and you've got a thing.
Yeah, but I can't do that.
You need to work on your circular breathing.
I do, yeah. I tried to do that when I learned to play the didgeridoo. Wasn't very good at it.
Play the didgeridoo?
Well, no, I tried to learn how to play the didgeridoo.
So you didgeridoo don't play it.
I didgeridoodle in it.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Let's talk about EE. Now, the UK's 4G mobile network, that is, EE, has announced plans to reduce, it's actually announced reductions on some of its prices, as well as some new price plans to encourage customers to sign up before its competitors get access to 4G wireless spectrum later this year. So for starters, the price of EE's entry-level package now has been reduced from £36 a month to £31 a month, although you still only get 500 meg of data, which I kind of think is one of the problems here. But it does come with unlimited calls and texts. For the uninitiated, and frankly, I think anyone listening to this podcast is probably aware of 4G. It's faster mobile download speeds on your phone. Let's just get that out of the way. But more exciting for download lovers, basically us, is EE's new 20 gigabyte data plans, which will start from £61 per month for 12 months, but you'll get a £15 discount for every one of those months if you sign up before the end of February. But that's just for the SIM card, so you need to bring your own 4G phone for that, like an iPhone or a... what else is there? Some other ones. Look on Wired, we've reviewed them all. Or you can get a 24-month contract that costs a little bit more, but you get a phone to use it with as well. And I think these are pretty significant steps for EE, even though they're quite small ones, because the network is still very expensive for data. Mm. It is faster, and I pay for £15 a month for my iPad for data only. And it is really fast, and it is quite nice to use. It does work. But to sort of get people away from the more capacious data allowances or the much, much lower price plans, like you can get unlimited data on 3 for about £12 a month, SIM only, I think they still need to do a bit more here. But it's a step in the right direction, and it does make me think they're getting a little bit nervous about the 4G spectrum auction, which is now taking place, that will then later this year allow networks like 3 and Vodafone to start offering competing 4G plans. And that will be interesting to watch. Ian, let's talk about Dutch architects. A particular one has planned to build the world's first 3D printed building, I hear.
Yes, and I apologise in advance if I pronounce his name wrong, because it's very Dutch, and I'm not sure. His name is Jan-Jaap Roysenaar, I think.
Good enough for me.
Yeah, but he's from a firm called Universe Architecture in Amsterdam, and they're planning on constructing the first building to be built with a 3D printer.
Okay.
This has been proposed before by a lot of people, but he says he's going to be the first one to do it, and they're using the biggest 3D printer in the world. He's working with an artist and mathematician called Rinus Roelofs on the design, which kind of looks like a Mobius strip. You know when you get a piece of paper and you fold it in on itself and it makes a continuous loop?
Yeah.
It's going to look like that, but imagine as kind of a...
But as a house.
As a house, yeah. The idea came, he told me, I spoke to him about this, he said that they were working on this competition in Ireland where they wanted to build a building that was kind of seamless, like the landscape. So you know how there's all kind of shapes, hills and things, but there's no edges or anything. Mm. They wanted to build a building that was kind of like that, but with a normal building, obviously you've got bricks and lines and windows and things. So they eventually settled on 3D printing as a way of making a model for a building that would have no seams and would be kind of continuous. So they talked to this guy called Enrico Dini, who built this huge 3D printer. It can print things that are 6 meters by 9 meters wide and over 9 meters tall.
Wow. So they're building this thing in sections.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It is originally planned to be done in sections, but theoretically it can be adapted to go round the outline of the house.
I'm with you.
Yeah, as a strip, and wow, actually lay a whole thing out one by one. And it's quite big. I mean, it's going to have 1,100 meters squared of floor space. And apparently cost between 4 and 5 million euros, which is like 3.3 million to 4.6 million pounds.
And I suppose the advantage here is that it can be reproduced and copied anywhere else.
Oh, exactly, yeah. And it uses really common materials. It's like ground down rocks, apparently, almost sand, which it lays down in layers and uses a kind of binding liquid, almost not cement, but kind of works in the same kind of way to keep it together. Mm. And then once they've built the actual shell, as it were, they'll put cladding on the outside, like steel, a bit of steel and some windows and things in it as well. But the main building, yeah, it'll be this kind of like sandstone-y stuff, artificial sandstone.
And I guess it could be used for low-cost housing.
Yeah, yeah. He said that they've been contacted by a South African company who are interested in kind of using it to print small, cheap houses for poor people down there. There's also apparently a Brazilian national park, I don't know which one, which wants to buy a copy for its visitor center.
Wow.
Which is quite nice. And this is exactly the same kind of thing which has been proposed by NASA and some other people to build lunar bases in the future. Like, you go up to the moon, you've got a lot of moon dust lying around, you can just put that into this kind of machine and build a building out of it. Since it saves you having to build one on Earth and fire up in a rocket and something and land it on there.
Someone needs to tell Grand Designs.
Yes.
Because that's exactly what I want to see on their next series. Well, we've got some pictures of the concept art behind these houses. If you go to wired.co.uk and search for probably Dutch architect, I'm pretty sure you'll find the picture in question. Liv, you wrote a piece this week about a public art project that lets you talk to postboxes and lampposts.
Yes.
Why would I want to talk to a lamppost, and who is telling me I do?
Why wouldn't you want to talk to a lamppost? No, this is a project by a studio called Pan Studio, and it's just won a competition for Bristol's Playable City Award. It's just won. It's got a £30,000 grant to implement their idea, which is to allow people to use a network of post boxes and lampposts and benches and various other pieces of city street furniture that we often ignore as a kind of gateway to a world of communications. Now, the way they plan on doing this is by taking advantage of the codes that city councils use to tell all these different objects from another. So when a light bulb breaks in a big lamppost, they have a code so they can direct the repair people to go and fix it, or if a bus stop needs to be rerouted or what have you. So the idea is that people will be able to send a text message to these inanimate objects and watch them come to life. That's the kind of principle.
Literally.
Not literally come to life, but they will start to communicate. So you'll send an SMS to a certain phone number that hasn't been decided yet with the word hello plus the name of the object. So hello postbox and plus the code. There's a 6-figure code on every postbox. So, you know, 654321, what have you. And then there'll be some pre-programmed responses, which will be questions to try and kind of engage you in a conversation initially. So it could be something as simple as, where am I? Or what do I look like? Or what's the most exciting thing to do around here? And the idea is that these are kind of conversation starters that people start to reply. And then once there have been enough replies, all these replies get stored on a kind of online database and are then fed back to other users when they next text that particular object.
Interesting.
So someone might say hello to that lamppost again, and they might say, oh, I've recently been told that the best place to get falafel is on this street. Do you agree?
I'd love it to work the other way around, where a lamppost texts you and says, oh, you just walked past me.
Yeah.
And you reply, say, what? Who are you? I'm a lamppost on the corner of the street. You just walked past, didn't you, and coughed.
And then film it and freak people out.
That'd be great.
It could be a little bit invasive if you got a message from every single piece of street furniture you walk past in Bristol.
I guess you could do it with Bluetooth. If you've chosen to have Bluetooth on, then...
Yeah, you could do. I mean, they're still ironing out the full ideas. I think the kind of In theory, they'd like to get kind of people involved in kind of creating their own games around this. So, you know, maybe creating like treasure hunts or getting historians to create little kind of tours of areas around Bristol.
That would be very cool, so actually. There's some great drain hole covers in Japan where every prefecture has its own unique design. They're usually coloured. They're incredibly amazing. We've done a gallery, actually. If you search for Japanese manhole covers on Wired, you'll probably find a great gallery. And because they've been there for quite a while, it'd be very interesting to be able to text one and say, tell me some of your history.
Yeah.
Like, what's your background?
Exactly.
Yeah, it'd be really cool.
So, yeah, it's still the early stages. It's not going to be live in Bristol until June and July, I think, or is it July and August? But yes, it's going to be in Bristol. It's going to be 2 months, and then it's going to tour to various other cities. So perhaps Japan, perhaps Tokyo might be on the list.
Interesting. Hope so. Well, we are going to take a quick trip into an ad break. But when we come back, we are going to discover what exactly revenge porn is and why it has been so significant in the news this week.
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Welcome back. Now, revenge porn is not something many people are familiar with. Don't worry, this conversation will be reasonably safe for younger listeners for the most part, I would say. But if you have some very small kids, you might want to just get rid of them for the time being. But this revenge porn is essentially a sexually explicit video of a person that has been uploaded to the internet without that person's consent and with the intention of embarrassing them or perhaps blackmailing or bribing them. Mm. There were some very extreme examples of this. A very sad example was with a girl called Amanda Todd, who was 15 when she committed suicide after nude photographs of her were captured on a webcam and then uploaded to the internet against her wishes. But a lot of this category of revenge pornography tends to be homemade sex tapes that were consensually recorded, but then maybe after a bad breakup, one of the ex-partners posts the video online, and there are a lot of, you know, kind of these user-submitted porn sites that host these. But this week, last week it was now, a lawsuit was filed against Texan.com, TEXXXAN.com. And the suit alleges that the creation of revenge porn actually violates privacy laws in the US. 16 women are suing in this lawsuit, and two of them are also telling their stories on a website called End Revenge Porn, which encourages victims of the practice and their sympathizers to lobby for the laws to be changed so that, quote, revenge porn is perceived to be a criminal offense. And I thought it was worth us talking about this a little bit because it's probably not something that the majority of our listeners are necessarily familiar with. Mm. But as things like user-submitted video has arisen, and we've got, you know, HD video recording on our phones, we've got video editing capabilities on our tablets and webcams and all this sort of stuff, this sort of thing is probably the sort of argument and debate that's going to start arising more and more, particularly as more and more of us are used to being on the net and being connected.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to talk just a little bit about sort of what we think of this. Like, is this something that we think should necessarily be illegal? Ian?
I was going to say, it already sounds like, I mean, the key thing in a lot of these is that they're kind of consensual homemade sex tapes, and you can kind of see it as a violation of almost like a civil contract. Mm. Anyway, when people upload it, kind of, if you upload it without the other person's permission, then you can, I think you probably would have grounds to sue them for something there,
yeah,
just in terms of like violation of a contract.
Well, over and above that, I was going to say that, you know, if you currently get filmed to be in any kind of TV show at the moment, in order for it to be broadcast, you need to sign a release form. And I imagine this is the same situation as that, in that it's not the process of making the sex tape. That's fine. You've consented at the time, but you did not consent to have that sex tape broadcast in any way. And so in uploading it and broadcasting it to the public, you're essentially doing that without someone's permission, and I think you should be it should be punishable accordingly.
I mean, there are comparisons that can be drawn in this country with things like paparazzi photography. So I mean, it's not illegal to, or it's not against laws or rights to walk down the street and take a photograph of a celebrity, say. That's
but
okay.
But they're public figures and it's seen to be
they are, but
interest.
taking pictures of people, yeah. It's like for a private, your private collection or whatever, fine. The when it comes into problems is when, say, those photos are maybe of you in a compromising situation and they're being published. Mm. And then, you know, publishers have to be very, very careful. And there are a lot of celebrities who it is just known are very litigious, and so you don't publish those. There are others that are less litigious, and they get published even more. That's why you tend to see a lot of photos, say, of Jennifer Aniston on, you know, the cover of magazines, because she's believed to be far less litigious than many other celebrities.
Okay. Mm. I guess what's also interesting is the idea that you might create a sex tape and as a couple and perhaps want to upload it to once some of these user-submitted sites, but then you break up, and then you might then want to retract that consent. I guess that gets into a very tricky territory, I think. But I guess what you would need to do is have some kind of process when you upload it to make sure that both all parties involved have, you know, consented to being in the video and it being broadcast. And then I guess whether you break up or not shouldn't really affect that kind of contract you have with the website, I'd imagine.
I mean, it's interesting to think about YouTube. I mean, there's something like, I don't know, 70 hours of video uploaded every minute to YouTube at this point. And you've got to think of all these people that are just in the background on videos or just passers-by or whatever.
Yeah.
How many of those people have signed release forms? Because if this was traditional media, television, broadcast, commercial stuff, then they would need release forms, or you need to blur their faces out and things like that. That doesn't... Those sort of laws aren't enforced in the same way on social media.
Making money off
but
them,
you
guess,
do have mechanisms on YouTube to flag a video if you have a problem with it or you don't want to be in a video. You can... There is a feedback loop there, and I don't know if all of these websites have that.
I think that, you know, as we move forward with technology and as processing power gets so much greater, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of this stuff still has to be manual and has to be flagged, it's because it takes so much time and bandwidth in order to process images and automatically blur faces. But for example, on Google Street View, if you see a person on Google Street View, you'll see their faces are blurred.
Yeah.
Now, that's not done by a person opening that image in Photoshop and blurring it out. That's done automatically. Google's image recognition system can detect a face and also a registration plate and I think some other things as well, and automatically blur that.
Yeah.
And so you have to think that maybe one of the kind of future laws or future things that these sort of websites operate under, if you're uploading user-submitted video, you have to be able to automatically blur faces or blur out identities or things like that to avoid these sorts of lawsuits where people are personally identifiable without their consent.
Yeah, I mean, didn't you suggest earlier the idea that you'd be able to somehow search to see if you're... I mean, I love this idea in some ways, that you might one day be able to do an image search to find your face, but I think there's some kind of terrifying repercussions of being in a world where you can search all images for your face.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying this, sort of suggesting this hypothetically before the show, that... It won't be like image recognition in videos is still very, very difficult. But the technology is coming on, and I don't think it's going to be that far in the future when you will be able to, say, upload a photograph or a couple of photos of yourself and see where on, say, YouTube or any other video sharing site, your face or something that looks like your face appears. Mm. So you could think, well, if you did do a lot of, I don't know, homemade sex tapes when you were a bit younger that have ended up online, you could find them, send takedown requests, and no one will be any the wiser. It's not that far away, I can't believe.
The kind of sinister side of it is you get a lot of traffic cameras at the moment have automatic number plate recognition in them. I mean, that information is just... They don't really do anything with that until, say, the car's reported missing.
Yeah.
Then they can search and see if it drove where it was driving around, so they can try and figure out where it went. You could imagine when we have CCTV cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
Having a future where, you know, you can be just tracked walking down the street.
See, I just can't imagine that would be something that anyone would allow to happen easily. The kind of data protection issues around that are, frankly, terrifying.
Well, we've got a story on the website, of course, that goes into quite a lot of detail about this particular lawsuit that's taking place at the moment, as well as these the women who are encouraging people to speak out. So if you want to get involved in that, you can. If you search for revenge porn on wired.co.uk, and please search for it on wired.co.uk and not Google, you'll find that story. And let us know what you think. If you have any views on what we've talked about, podcast@wired.co.uk or politely on our Facebook wall, Facebook.com/WiredUK. Right, we've got a couple more news stories we want to get to. And the first of this is for our resident North Korean expert.
An Young.
Ian. Western tourists in North Korea now allowed to take their phones into the country. Now, this is massive news.
Yeah, because they, if you went to North Korea before, they'd take your phone off you at the border. And even they'd even ask which ones had GPS, like smartphones, and they put them in a little lead box.
This happened to you?
Yeah. They take them away, and then when you come back and you're leaving the country, they give them back to you. And
How many people visit the country?
Lots of diplomats.
There's Chinese officials.
Tens of thousands of Chinese tourists every year and several thousand Western tourists every year.
They must have these huge stores for people's
phones. Yeah,
I think
that's why they put the GPS ones in a lead box, because they don't want people to be able to track where they're taking them. Because when you get them back, there's always this suspicion. Like, I know
people swap them or track them.
Well, they go on them and like messages have been read and stuff like that, and there's like, you're sure they've been hacked. But anyway, no longer, that's not happening anymore. What's happening now is if you go to North Korea, you'll be told, apparently, according to tour groups that are going at the moment, you can keep your phone, and not just keep your phone, you can use it inside the country.
Wow.
Which isn't, you have to buy a new SIM card when you're there. Apparently in Pyongyang Airport there is a stall selling SIM cards. It costs like €50 to buy a SIM card with credit on it.
Wow.
That you can top up at a later date if
you want
to come back
again.
Well,
it's probably to help their economy,
to be honest. I'm sure it is. And business people will love it. I mean, you can't make internal calls. You're still very much separated from everyday citizens, but you can make international calls. And even apparently, according to the Xinhua news agency, which is a Chinese news agency, they've been told that in the future, tourists will be allowed to use their internet on their phones inside North Korea.
North Korea's phone network is entirely 3G.
It is, yeah.
100%.
It was set up by Orescom, which is an Egyptian company. The rumor is, everyone's reports this as being true, but no one's really sure if it is true. The rumor was that they were given the contract to do that, and in return they had to, you know, the Hotel of Doom in Pyongyang.
Yeah,
The rumor was that they had to pay to renovate that because it had just been sitting empty since the 80s, and now it's been finished. And Kempinski, which is like a super luxurious Swiss hotel chain, has bought the lease to that hotel, and it's going to be opening later this summer. So if you go to North Korea, you can stay in a luxury hotel in Pyongyang.
Wow.
But they have a very well developed 3G network, and it costs not too much to call home. It's like €1.58 to call back to the UK from inside North Korea.
Wow, that's cheaper than it costs to call from America.
Yeah.
On three.
Very competitive. Yeah. So, I wouldn't say this is some kind of wider opening of the country. Like, ordinary people, nothing will change for them. But, if you're a Westerner going there, it's pretty interesting because you can call home and say, "Hi, Mum, I'm calling from North Korea."
And they'll say, "Get out, for the love of all things sacred, get out." No, they weren't really. Interesting. Good. I actually really quite fancy going to North Korea.
I know someone running a trip later this year.
Really?
Yeah.
Let's talk about this off air.
I was telling Duncan about this. I'll send you the link.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, read about my future adventures perhaps on a future blog, in a future podcast. There's one little thing we wanted to mention. Who remembers last year Sony, the PlayStation Network, getting hacked? And there being a huge controversy over the fact that it was down for weeks and weeks and loads of problems. You remember, Ian?
I do remember now.
I thought that was a significant intake of breath.
Yeah, no, it was all coming back to me. It's just such a long time ago, 2012.
It was earlier than that. It was April 2011. Anyway, the Information Commissioner's Office has fined Sony around £250,000 for the hack. If you don't remember, people listening, the personal data for millions of customers stored on this network was compromised during this hack of Sony's servers, which included names, email addresses, postal addresses, dates of birth, user account passwords, and it was possible that credit card details as well may have been accessed. And the ICO investigation has pointed out that basically Sony didn't have up-to-date software and so failed to provide an appropriate level of security for this customer data, and that's hence the reason this fine is so large. Commenting, David Smith, Deputy Commissioner and Director of Data Protection at the ICO, said, quote, "If you're responsible for so many payment card details and login details, then keeping that personal data secure has to be a priority. In this case, that just didn't happen, and when the database was targeted, albeit in a determined criminal attack, the security measures in place were simply not good enough." The ICO actually said this was one of the most serious ever reported to them, although Sony's less convinced it's going to appeal this decision. But an interesting closure to this story that unfortunately has dragged on for quite a long time and got Sony a lot of bad PR. Hopefully they can now put this behind them, at least until someone makes some revenge porn of a PlayStation.
Okay.
Hope not.
I just wonder what would that look like? Yeah. What would that look like?
Draw a picture, send it. podcast@wired.co.uk. But before we go down that route any further, it's time to wrap up the show. Olivia, how do people get in touch with their opinions?
They can get all up in our grill with their opinions. So I've been watching Made in Chelsea recently. I don't know if anyone saw it.
No.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. We have a delightful Facebook page. Facebook.com/WiredUK. And you can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Do so. And we will return next week with another thrilling tour down the motorway of news in wired.co.uk.
A motoring tour.
Bus of information.
Nice.
I'm going to go now. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, I don't know if angels are magic, are they? Are they meant to be magic, or are they kind of holy?
Holy magic.
It's like separate in Final Fantasy. Mean,
they're white mages.
Does God conform to the laws of physics?
I think by definition he doesn't.
No, absolutely not.
So then, but then should angels...
Like a miracle by definition is a violation of the laws of nature. It is. According to Hume, at least.
Mm. It is.